You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. It's day five with the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location at Slam Dance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of this year's most important and exciting voices in independent film. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. On today's show, we're going to be doing a roundtable with some programmers. We've got Tim League. He's the CEO and co-founder of Alamo Drafthouse. And we've also got Andrew Rogers. He's the executive director at Denver Film Festival. We have the film Paddleton. The director, Alex Lehman, is going to be here talking about that film. And Ms. Purple. Justin Chan is back at Sundance. He's the director of that film with his co-writer, Chris Din, and two stars of the film, Tiffany Chu and Teddy Lee. And then finally, the documentary Kefaru. And on that one, we've got David Hambridge. He's the director and DP, as well as Andrew Brown. He's a producer and editor on the film. We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And we have a programmers and trade roundtable is what we're calling this. But we're going to be going all over the map, I think, in this conversation. Because we have Tim Lee, who's the CEO and co-founder of Alamo Drafthouse. And Andrew Rogers, who's the executive director at the Denver Film Festival. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to start this off talking about every year we have a number of articles. What are distributors looking for, and what do filmmakers need to do? You two, because I've known you for quite a while, and you've been here, been coming to this thing for quite a while, and you're either choosing films, you're either distributing films. You're coming at it from a very knowledgeable place of that transaction. So, Tim, What are you looking for when you're looking for a film to pick up?
This is going to sound revolutionary, but we're looking for really good stories.
But it's crazy.
What does that mean?
Crazy
That's
talk.
A secret.
I mean, there's no real quota, but our process is we try to get as much coverage as possible, and we keep up a dialogue afterwards, and if it's a really good story, then we look at past comps of like, do we think this is going to make this for the Neon side of things,
right.
And then for the Alamo side, it's a little more straightforward. But we try to put together sort of an idea of what we think this movie can make box office wise in the digital space, and then sort of almost craft a marketing campaign and try to find the audience for it. And so that drives what we look for buying films while we're up here.
Now, by this point, when you're watching a film, mm-hmm. Can you separate yourself enough to just literally enjoy the film, or do things start clicking into gear as you're watching a film going, oh, I see what we could do, does that thought process start to creep in?
You know what creeps in is that doesn't really. If I'm into a movie, then I get lost in it and I love it. And that's really the first step, is we have to love the movie, and then we start working on the marketing campaign and putting the spreadsheet together. What pulls me out of the movie is when it's just like, oh God, why did you do that? So that's not like on the negative side. So I get pulled out when it's when there's problems. So.
And Andrew, let's talk from the film festival side. Because again, you know, you've been at a few film festivals as you've done the thing that you do. Talk about what's going through your head as you're assessing the films that are out there and whether or not you think they're right, in this case, for Denver.
Sure. Well, it's interesting because I think that what Tim said is totally right on for us as well. I mean, we're looking for stories that we connect with. And when I say we've got a team of about four of us up here. And we all have different tastes and different interests, and so we're all seeing whatever. We're not covering everything, but we're seeing a lot. And when we're watching films, I think it's just does it click? Does it strike us? Is it something we fall in love with? That's always been my approach. I don't really, to your question a minute ago, I don't really sort of calculate my head as we're going, like, oh, this is good for this audience or that. It's just, is it good? But the exact opposite is true, as Tim said. It's like when you're pulled out of a film, and for me, the best indicator, which is like a subconscious indicator, is when I look at my watch. When I look at my watch in the middle of a movie, then I know. And the number of times I look at my watch is the better indicator of like how much has this film taken me out of it. So.
It reminds me of the old story of Jack Warner with the pee break test, and it was like, you know, how long he would last watching a film before he went on a pee break, and that would determine whether or not, you know, they thought, you know, they were going to really get behind the film at Warner Brothers.
Does he have an abnormally small bladder?
It was kind of infamous, and people and filmmakers, you know, the directors when they were, you know, screening their finished, you know, film for him, would be just nervous as hell that you know, that Jack was going to get up. All right, and this is the fun part where we start asking you two. One, what's your favorite thing that you've seen thus far?
Ooh.
Tim, you get to lead off.
Well, I mean,
it's thus far, so I'm giving you an out.
I am involved in buying films that I love, so I mean, I have an out. So I'll answer two, because we bought two films.
Okay.
We bought a small Colombian film called Monos, and then we bought The Lodge, the midnight movie.
Oh, really like The Lodge.
I really like The Lodge too. So I love both of those films, and we proved our love in a very commercial way. you know, other than that, so I was at The Lodge, and I was talking to somebody, and he said, "You know what the worst movie of Sundance is?" He was so angry about it, and it's The Death of Dick Long, and so I immediately went to go see it the next day, and I really love it. It's somebody described it to me as Dumb and Dumber meets Fargo, directed by, you know, one of the Daniels from Swiss Army Man. It's like, I'm
Sounds amazing. Like, yeah.
How is it the worst? I think it's really extraordinary.
Wow.
And dumb and awesome.
Great.
So now I know in future Fest to use reverse psychology on you.
Yes. A double dog dare you to say this.
Yeah, Tim, you're going to hate my movie. You're going to just really hate my movie. All right, Andrew, you've had some time now. What's up?
So I'm kind of approaching this a little bit differently, where I'm my core programming staff are checking out specific things, and I'm trying to hit other areas that I'm thinking that they may be missing. So, you know, my favorite so far, I really... I loved Knocking Down the House, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez movie. Mm-hmm. That was a really sort of a surprisingly lovely and emotional film. On the narrative side, I really liked Late Night, you know, which obviously got picked up for a ton of money, which is great. But that was like, to me, it was sort of note perfect, and it was lovely, and I think it's going to do really well. And then there's some other movies like Apollo 11, which I think is just catnip for certain audiences, and that was a lot of fun. And I can see that doing really well, both theatrically for a niche audience and also festivals. those are a couple of my favorites, I think.
Okay, all right. Now here's the second part of this. A discovery. Something that just totally just came out of nowhere for both of you. Wasn't being pushed by a publicist, so you weren't looking for their performance, you know, or the film that they directed, but you're just going, who the heck is this chick? Who? What about this guy? Where did he come from? Andrew, you get to start off.
Yeah, Tim and I were actually talking about this ahead of time. I don't know that there's been massive discoveries. The one that, you know, to some degree, I've sort of found surprising. There's a movie called Top End Wedding.
Yes, we just saw that yesterday.
We'll be speaking with them. Yep.
Which was really interesting because I hated the first scene of that movie. I mean, I hated
it. Oh.
The first scene of that movie, I almost walked out of the movie. And I was like, oh, come on. I'm not going to give it away. It was inconsequential to the story. But I hated it so much. And then the movie started going on, and I'm like, oh, I'll stick around. And then, oh, I kind of like it. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, that was really sweet. Mm-hmm. So by the end, it was like something that I completely, the arc of my, you know, emotions watching that movie was kind of interesting and unusual, I have to say.
Okay, Tim.
I mentioned of the last question Monos, which was not on our radar. It was a low priority, but it's so visually staggering. It's a gorgeous film. So that certainly falls into the discovery category. I also was kind of blown away by the untitled Amazing Jonathan documentary. It's there's been so much conversation about this movie of what's true, what's not. It sort of turns the documentary form on its head a little bit, and I'm still thinking about it. So I'm a fan.
For me, that's success. If, mm-hmm. if you can get somebody to continue to chew on a movie mm-hmm. after they've seen it, then that's the thing. Actually, by talking about Top End Wedding, you gave me an idea that mm-hmm. I really would want to talk about. And it's romantic comedies on the film festival circuit. Mm-hmm. Because I think they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. But this year, I will be helping launch a new rom-com fest in Los Angeles in July. And so therefore, now I'm really on the lookout for these. But talk about, from both your perspectives, why is it difficult for indie films or for on the film festival circuit for us to find romantic comedies?
That's a good question. I mean, I think comedies in general are sort of fewer and far between in the entire independent spectrum. I don't have an answer why. I think, if you talk to some people, they'd say, well, comedies are harder to do. Maybe that has something to do. I don't know. But I don't know. I think, are independent audiences jaded and romantic comedy seems too broad and it's not artistic or something? I don't know. I don't have a good answer.
Tim?
I think it's suffering some fate that maybe genre films did 10 years ago, right? That's sort of relegated to be this pop culture type mm-hmm. of film. And that's obviously changed. I mean, genre has there's a wave of genre on this film festival. But I think that people are still sort of dismissive of it, which is not fair. One of my favorite movies of the festival circuit, I think it's still in festivals, but is getting a tiny little release, is a movie called Slut in a Good Way. It's a French-Canadian kind of coming-of-age rom-com, and it's awesome. I don't know when your festival is, but if that's still on the circuit, you should look at that.
I'm totally lighting it up.
Yeah, right. That's title, right?
Perfect for Bitch Talk. Thank you. I wanted to quickly talk about Alamo Drafthouse because we're out of San Francisco and mm-hmm. you guys are still a little bit new to the area. I was a little bit of a naysayer when I heard that you guys were coming in because you're coming to the Mission mm-hmm. and there's a lot of changes in the Mission, but you came in, you hired people from in the neighborhood, and you also housed Lost Weekend Video. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about coming into cities and folding in the community?
Sure. So my wife and I, started the theater, I don't want to say way too many decades ago, but and it was intended to be just this single screen neighborhood community theater. And then as we grew, that's my big neuroses about, I don't want to just grow and cookie cutter it out. And so it's our plan for growth is to always build community theaters. And so that's integral to that is hiring a community liaison, a creative director, a local bartender, a local chef, and give them a lot of freedom, put some guardrails on it, but it's theirs to engage with the community. Otherwise, it's not a theater that I'd want to go to. So it's more challenging, I think, to grow it that way, but that's the only way I'm comfortable doing it.
And we appreciate it.
It shows.
Yeah, and we've embraced it. So
awesome. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks.
Tim had no idea when he came here he was going to have fans. All right, and Andrew, we don't have a lot of time left, but the Denver Film Festival, I was fortunate a few years ago to be on the jury there. Loved it. It is, I think, one of the great fests on the regional tour. Talk about your experiences now. This is what, year two or three for you? Year three. Talk about your time at Denver.
Sure. Yeah, I I was really fortunate to have the opportunity to come out to Denver. And it's a really interesting organization. This year is its 42nd year. Started as the Denver Film Festival, and we have a year-round theater. Sea Film Center, and then we do this gigantic summer screening series out at Red Rocks called Film on the Rocks, which you really haven't lived until you've stood on stage with an army of stormtroopers in front of 8,500 people.
I haven't lived.
true. So yeah, it's been a great festival. I think in the last 5 or 10 years, it's really kind of picked up steam in some really nice ways. And we're known for international films, but also for being a stop on the awards release schedule. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah, I highly recommend that fest to anybody who has a chance to go to it. Again, we've been talking with Tim League. He's the CEO and co-founder of Alamo Drafthouse, and Andrew Rogers, the executive director at Denver Film Festival. Guys, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. This segment, we're going to talk about the film Paddleton. We've got the director, Alex Lehman, with us. Alex, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Alex, we start these segments off by letting our director introduce our listeners to the film. So, tell us about Paddleton.
Paddleton's, thank you for having me here, by the way. Paddleton's about this platonic relationship, love, that these two older men have, and it explores what that relationship, it's a really unique relationship, it explores what it is by kind of testing them with pitting them against terminal cancer and how they handle it, letting go. And it's specifically about a relationship that we don't really have a model for in our, you know, in our world right now. It's these two older men who they just love each other. They get each other. They're loners. They're kind of these guys that if you see them walking down the street, you might think they're a little strange, or you might even, you know, have some preconceptions, or maybe call them creepy or something. We all judge a little bit, but they found each other, and they get each other in a way that you hope that just one person in the world could possibly understand you that much. So it's a really special, lucky relationship they have.
It is a very unique relationship and very, very funny.
yes.
And of course, naturally, it's going to be funny when you have the two guys starring in the film.
I thought you were going to say naturally it's going to be funny because there's cancer.
Oh, well, that too. That's a hilarious topic.
That kind of goes without saying as well. But talk about the two guys that play these friends and how they became part of the project.
Well, there's these two guys that have some experience with comedy. Their names are Ray Romano.
Can you spell that?
Oh, okay.
And Mark Duplass. Yeah. So both very, very funny men who are also excellent storytellers in a lot of different genres and in a lot of different ways. And so the way this came about, I've worked with Mark on a few projects. I made a documentary with him called Asperger's Are Us, which was a comedy. And then I made a film with him called Blue Jay, which was a two-hander starring him and Sarah Paulson. Mm. So we decided we wanted to do another kind of two-hander and explore, you know, a different kind of relationship in this one. And Ray's Big Sick had just come out, and, you know, you just kind of look at what he's doing there. And, I mean, we jumped on it. I feel like we got so lucky because obviously, you know, as soon as you see what he's doing in Big Sick and in Parenthood and his show Men of a Certain Age, trying to plug every Ray Romano.
Yeah.
You're like his agent or something. Yeah.
He slipped you a 20 before this interview.
he could only afford a 10, actually. Ray's struggling. You
all
know.
In one.
So really? The nine seasons of his sitcom. I think that's all. Okay.
But let's talk about that, you know, working with these two guys, because on one hand with Mark, you know, you've had experience working with him, but this type of production, you know, budget-wise, you know, time-wise, you know, story-wise, is so in his wheelhouse it's one of the most fortunate things to have a guy like that not only in your cast but on your set with you.
Yeah, and not only on your set, but when you realize that, you know, Duplass is a brand that also has a relationship with Netflix. So, you know, when you come to Mark and say, hey, there's this story I want to do, and he says, great, I want to act in it. You know that it means he can call up a guy like Ray, and he can call up this little company called Netflix, and things start working in a more turnkey way. And then, as you said, really importantly, there is I guess you could call it a creative safety net, where you know that, like, you can try weird and crazy things and you don't have to feel like you have to have every single answer, because there really is a talented guy there. By the way, Romano, I would say same thing again, just a really knowledgeable storyteller, and, you know, and he understands how to craft a joke or a scene, you know, just from what his set work is and everything. So I'd be crazy not to look at those guys and say, you know, does it feel like we're getting this? Because it's improv. We did a lot of improv, which I'm sure is a key point that I should be talking about. We had an outline, but every scene was improvisation. We would start with a point A. We knew we needed to get to point D. We're going to have to hit B and C along the way, but, like, everything in between was going to be just kind of exploration. and improv, and so you just kind of put the cameras on the faces and let the genius happen.
Hmm. I was going to bring up that on Bitch Talk, we talk a lot about toxic masculinity. And this was really a story about mindful masculinity, a term we just learned at the Women's March last week, and that we love. But can you talk more about that storyline and how that was crafted, how important it was?
Will you define mindful masculinity?
I think it more has to do with, we look at the word masculinity and it has a negative connotation, and but embracing that masculinity and realizing that it's not just one thing, it can also be
multiple
facets to masculinity. It's not just one thing, like I'm a jock and I'm strong and I don't cry. It can mean other things, it's layered.
Yeah, I would say that it's who these guys are. It's a little hard for me to talk about this because, I mean, that I'm not, a toxic masculine.
That's you're a mindful word, right? Masculine.
I'm a mindful masculine. Yeah. And a lot of people I know are like that. So I guess we could be talking about that sociologically, but there are people like that. I know people like that. And this just happens to be a story about two people who are connecting on other things and, you know, don't have some, I mean, yeah, sure, they're not aggressive and they obviously didn't inherit some sort of limited, old-fashioned definition of masculinity from their dad. Like, there's obviously some stuff there, but, I think we were just exploring more their connection. Do you guys think that kind of connection, that kind of friendship goes against what masculinity is in our mind?
I think you just don't see that a lot on the big screen or the small screen. So it was just really pleasant to watch that part of their relationship.
It's true that usually we have to diffuse, when we make movies about something, you know, a closeness like that, you have to start making jokes, gay jokes or non-gay jokes or something to diffuse it. So I guess there's something there just where we want to diffuse the discomfort of feeling that close to
I would say that one of the obvious comparisons, the classic comparisons, is The Odd Couple, but you're steering clear of that Neil Simon-esque humor, and then if you update it, the Judd Apatow style of the bromances, which also takes things to a different level, to a different extreme, and you're steering clear of that. And I think to the great credit of the film, that there's I would call it almost a muted style to the comedy, which of course I think lends itself more to the warmth, between the two guys.
Yeah, I wish I could say I was smart enough to be redefining what masculinity is, but these are relationships I have with my friends. So I just wanted to portray that.
So you're inventing games like Paddleton with you.
Inventing games like Paddleton since I've been a kid.
Exactly.
But that's part of it too. We can say these guys are advanced in some ways, but they also have the emotional regulation of teenagers. They're children dealing with cancer and letting go and not knowing how to face it, let alone express themselves through it. So. They're by no means perfect.
one scene in particular, it kind of runs through the film that I want you to talk about is Ray Romano's character, his disdain for small talk, and the scene where the woman in his office comes over to say something to him, and basically how he sends her away. Talk about that scene in particular, because I loved that thing.
I haven't gotten to direct too much like comedy, but that was one where Ray improvised the hell out of that scene. There were like 5 minute long takes. I wish I could show you guys the discomfort of this woman not willing to leave his presence and him not knowing how to say, he started talking. He would try to make small talk. I know I'm talking about stuff that's not in the movie, but that means, you get the gist of what is in the movie. He started making small talk about Susan that works in the office, who's a lightning survivor. And, just the craziest stuff, she's nice. Well, I mean, sort of, and he's just struggling to say anything. And there's an honesty. I mean, I'm stuck with that. There's an honesty to who I am, and there's a hatred for small talk I just told someone yesterday, like, when you start talking to me about the weather, that I'm standing here, you know, I just want to give you a hug and say, it's okay. Like,
we can just, everything's okay.
Yeah. We can just
hold hands.
Yeah. Hold hands or not talk or whatever.
Was it the same with the halftime speech? Like, how much of that was improv?
Okay.
That was, we were cracking.
I couldn't.
So actually kind of in reverse of what, you know, some of the scenes were, Ray actually brought the improv or the halftime speech to us while we were prepping, you know, because we were doing this like write rehearse kind of thing, just kind of developing the script. And he's like, I got this halftime speech, and it kind of like thematically maybe folds in a little bit. And I was like, oh my gosh,
it really,
yes,
wow.
Okay. And so we're like, we're gonna drop it in here. Like, we're gonna have him start talking about it. We're gonna have him like do it to himself here. And then we'll chase it as like possibly one of the payoffs for the end of the movie, which, you know, obviously.
He's really trying to sell it. I mean, really.
Like in real life, he real was, life. Yeah.
We went for a hike for a morning, and we just, he was just working his material out on me. You know, I can't say I added much to it, but for like a morning, it was just me and Ray just hiking, talking. He was just trying, you're watching A-level comedian work on this brilliant bit. It was just absolutely a blast to craft it with him. Yeah.
Wow. I wish that was filmed.
Well, the film is both a blast as far as being funny, and it gets you as well.
Yes. So touching. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, the film, the title is Paddleton, screening at Sundance. We've been talking to Alex Lehman, the director. Alex, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having
me.
Thank
you. Loved it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with the Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW. This episode is supported in part by Black Rain, Studio Movie Grill, and Slopestyle Realty.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk co-host Aaron Lin and Angela Tabora. And we are the team for the Daily Buzz here up at Sundance and Slam Dance. And right now we're going to talk about the film Kefaru. It's a Slam Dance title. David and Andrew, why don't you introduce yourselves?
My name is David Hambridge. I'm the director for the film Kefaru and the cinematographer. And Andrew's here with me. He can introduce himself.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Andrew.
He's sitting right
that's
here.
A, that's how this relationship goes. Yeah. My name's Andrew. I am the producer and editor on the film. Yeah.
Okay, and we always let our filmmaker, our director, introduce our listeners to the film. So tell us about Kefaru.
Well, Kefaru is it's Swahili for rhinos or the rhinos, but we actually, the film is about the last male northern white rhino, Sudan, who actually passed last year, March 19th. He was the last male of his kind. He was a one-of-a-kind animal, and there's two northern white rhinos left, and it's about the caretakers, the Kenyan caretakers mm-hmm. that took care of him for 3 years. We started filming leading up to kind of his last moments, and we kind of explore the pitfalls of life. And when it's, you know, we're there with, we go home with them, we meet their families. You know, we were there when they had their children, their firstborns, mm-hmm. and so they're attached to this animal, Sudan, the last of his kind, who also has a global interest for his DNA, and they also, you know. In his last moments, they needed to harvest his DNA and cryogenically freeze it to hopefully save the species, and that's still happening. Like, right. They're trying to do that still.
I'm familiar with this because I saw Kate Brooks's Last Animals, mm-hmm. Which also deals with this, and it's really tough to watch, and very important to watch. But I would like for you to, David, to talk about your approach in filming this, and from a filmmaker's viewpoint versus, say, an activist viewpoint, which you almost can't get away from.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I try to stay away from the activist part of it because these guys are my friends. Like, James Wind, our main character, like, he, you know, hit me up on WhatsApp last night, like, how are things going? are people talking about the film? Did you get your posters up? You know, like, so... It's more of a like bond between me as a director, filmmaker, living with them, getting to know them. Us, you know, our last production trip with Andrew, we climbed Mount Kenya together, and That's a second highest peak in Africa.
Not even for the film, just
not for the film, just
get
for
away,
fun.
Just to get away from wildlife, and they were exhausted, and it was almost therapeutic.
Yeah, it was right after Sudan passed. We just were like, you know what? We've been with you guys for 3-4 years. Like, you've been with us, you know, through the highs and lows, and there were many highs and also a couple lows. And you know, there's baby rhinos that were rescued that came in during the production that were unexpected, and they're so sweet. One of them, he's in the film, his name's Ringo.
Ringo.
Named after Ringo Starr. Yeah. It was really just, I wanted to be there and tell the story through the guys' lenses, their eyes, and how they're experiencing it firsthand and in real time, especially leading up to those last moments with Sudan. So I tried not to get into how I feel, and I never even really thought about how I felt when we were there filming his last breaths, and I just tried to focus on James and him. He was pacing, and we just tried to follow, you know, what it's like to kind of watch these scientists, you know, handle their business to this animal that 2 days ago you were giving him, you know, a mud bath and doing your daily routines. Now you've shifted to facilitating DNA extraction. It's just it's crazy. So, but it wasn't. Yeah, I can't say it was I took a activist point of view to tell this story. I wanted to tell it in a human way that we all can relate to, you know?
Yeah, I like how you say that you not only wanted the viewer to see what's happening, but to feel what's happening. And this is definitely told from the point of view of not just the animal, but those that are caring for the animal and their livelihoods and the effect that it has on them. And it kind of made me think of, like, that's what we can hope for as a human. Like, at the end of my life, it'll be defined by the people who supported me and took care of me. So I thought that was a really powerful way to tell the story.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they speak for themselves, and I think your connection with them as a viewer is very present, and you can identify with them on so many issues and so many levels. I mean, their laughter is contagious, you know, and they attempted flying a kite throughout the whole production, and that's a thing that I hope you guys catch on. But it's fun, you know, like they're innocent and they're young, and they have this hard task of taking care of this docile old rhino, and they dearly loved him, and they still carry and talk about him, you know, very highly, and they're all friends, you know. All those guys would not have been probably friends if it wasn't for Sudan. He was kind of the connective tissue.
Yeah. Because
they're from different tribes in Kenya.
And Andrew, we want to get you in here and talk about the editing of this film. And talk about how, given the footage that David supplied you with, how you created that balance, how you crafted that story in the editing bay.
Yeah, it was actually difficult. So we got back, we were shooting in April, and we were shooting together, and then we went straight into editing. And then we had to somewhat divide and conquer, because David and I, it's just two people essentially wearing all the hats, trying to figure it all out. And so we would just divide and conquer. I think the actual stitching the story together, we knew that we wanted to tell it we knew that we had very clear character arcs that were important to us. And what we didn't want to do is create a story that only wildlife activists connected with. We wanted to extend that audience into people that might not care, which is okay. We want to open up the conversation to those people that say, you know what, I didn't connect with this, but I do connect with a father that is using this tourism and this tourism for people to come see this rhino. It's providing for his family, or it's keeping his son in school, where without education, you know, they're somewhat trapped within social poverty. So I hope people can connect with that and say, you know, I felt those pressures to care for the ones that I love or to provide for others that I love. And so even if you don't connect with wildlife conservation, you're still going to get a lot out of this story. So that was the main focus as we were stitching this together. And then just do it in an honest way, a patient way, a simple way. We didn't try to sensationalize everything. We wanted moments to breathe instead of trying to make it, you know, this action-packed wildlife poachers are coming around the corner every single night. It's not like that. It's just not like that. So we wanted to be true and just tell an honest story.
And when you have a film like this, oftentimes this happens with documentaries, but especially recently now with environmentally focused documentaries. There's a different aspect to, say, doing a film festival tour, to traveling with the movie and to getting out there. Are you guys, prepared to do that? Is this something now that you've gone through the filming and the experience of being there and editing this? Is that something you relish? Going with the movie and talking about it and
yeah, ultimately, and I'll let David kind of go from it, but ultimately we do want to bring the guys over. We're working towards that. We do have a very impressive festival lineup filling up. It was important to us that we started early, and Slam Dance was a great opportunity for that. But we can't announce everything yet, but we'll be around around the world. We have some great festivals all throughout the U.S. and hopefully get people talking about this.
I think this won't really seem real. I mean, we haven't had our premiere, this is Saturday, but I don't think it'll really feel real to me until like James and JoJo, our mm-hmm. main characters, are here with us and can also be there for the Q&A, because people are not going to want to talk to us. They're going to want to, talk to the Indian guys. They're just charming and fun.
All we do is push buttons. These guys talk to rhinos, with rhinos.
Hit record and followed them, and they just, the story unfolded. So we got really lucky. And I think people will enjoy the film and really be touched by it, so that's what we hope for.
I know you guys are looking forward to getting them, in the mix on your tour, but I know the audiences at Slam Dance are going to be looking forward to talking to the two of you. Again, the film is Kefaru. We've been talking with David Hambridge, who's a director and DP on the film, and Andrew Brown, who's a producer and editor. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And this segment is about Ms. Purple, which is screening at Sundance. We have with us the director, Justin Chan. We have Chris Din, the co-writer. And also in the film, the cast members, Tiffany Chu and Teddy Lee. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Okay. Yeah. Now, and of course, I'm particularly very excited about this because, Justin, we had you and the crew in for Gook a couple years ago. The critically acclaimed film, and I say critically acclaimed because I'm one of the critics who claimed it was awesome.
It was beautiful.
So why don't you lead us off by introducing our listeners to Ms. Purple and what it's about.
The film is about a strange brother and sister that are reconnecting during their the final days of their father's life. The main character, Casey, played by Tiffany, works as a karaoke hostess mm-hmm. to make ends meet and pay for hospice care. Mm-hmm. That's the gist of it.
All right, and Tiffany, I really excited to hear you talk about your work in the film, because so much of the time, our camera is focused on you mm-hmm. and we are living and dying in each moment by how your character is mm-hmm. navigating her way through this. And I would love for you to talk about working with Justin to get that nuance that I think is in this film and that makes it succeed.
Mm-hmm. Working with Justin and also working with Teddy was definitely a big challenge, because this character, Casey, it calls for so much emotional depth. And you have to go to places where most people don't want to go. And it's great because I have the opportunity to be this vessel, to play this character that everybody could relate to in some form of way. And also, it's just really grateful that, I get to be an actor and I get to just play this character. While I think this film talks about something bigger than that, that, there's a lot of people that go through this and the fact that they live in this in their reality every day. And so working with this was a big challenge. We had to overcome some difficult things, and playing this character was, truthfully, it was not fun. Because if you actually did live in this character's shoes,
it would be tough.
It'd be very tough.
Really tough.
Exactly.
But it's real.
It is real.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the dynamic between, because I want to bring Teddy into this with the two of you. And Teddy, talk about that. When you're actors, you're sitting on the set waiting for stuff to happen. I'm sure Justin's set like moved along swimmingly and things were just happening, in a crackerjack pace. But even with...
How do you know I move like that?
I'm just guessing here.
You can tell by your vibe.
But Teddy and Tiffany, and Teddy, you start. Talk about how you two were able to build that proper dynamic between you.
Spent a lot of time together.
Yeah?
We did spend a lot of time.
A ton of time together. The whole month, like prior to the shoot, we had the house that we were renting out for the shoot to ourselves, and we basically spent the hours of like we would get and meet there around like 9 a.m. and stay there for about 12 hours a day.
Now, are both of you guys homework actors? So, like, have all kinds of notes on the side of the script, or are you just like in the moment, just going, "Here's my lines," and now we're just
kind of like
for
went
it.
Back and forth. Like, whenever we would get tired of going over the script and going over the scenes, we would just, I don't know, we would just do normal things, eat.
Yeah. And like a lot of it was also like us helping, talking about our relationship. You know, like memories. It was a lot of visualization. But what else? Your process?
I mean, for me, a lot of it was just establishing an organic dialogue between us. Like the connection should feel natural. So when what you see on screen isn't acting, as it still is. I don't know when but it's...
Keep going.
Justin told me this morning, don't say I don't know. it was a really good experience. It was something that... it was a process that I... Because no directors will give you that amount of rehearsal time. But we were lucky enough to have that, and it's... It's something
especially
that I've always
on an independent film.
Yeah,
you,
it's something
you
that
cannot
I've always
count
read
that.
About growing up, and I've always, but almost every actor, every working actor would tell me, like, it doesn't exist, that rehearsal time doesn't exist. But.
Awesome. And now, Chris, we might get you in here, co-writer on this, and let's talk about the scripting process and affecting that balance between the relationship story that you're telling between a brother and sister, and then also the element with the karaoke guys and the girls that are brought in, because that's almost it almost lends itself to even like a little bit of a thriller aspect to it, that it has that kind of edge, and that's a careful balance to get in the script. Talk about that.
The aspect of the karaoke world,
of making sure that you're balancing it correct between the relationship dynamic and then that world, the karaoke world.
I see. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think I feel like most of our conversations were really about the, I guess, understanding the world, and then it always was about the relationships. That's interesting. I haven't heard that.
Well, that's why you're doing the show, because we're the only ones who will ask you this kind of thing.
No, that's great. That's great. I mean, thinking in terms of it as a thriller aspect is really interesting. But I don't know if that was ever something that we like actively talked about. Maybe it's more the nature of that world. But
I think that aspect is what keeps the tension in the film going, and definitely it's the side that's starting to grow, which is going to come to a head at some point. So towards the climax, that is going to have to come to a head. So it brings a lot of tension, in the film.
I guess we're always aware of tension, but but I think what we spent most of our time on was always the relationships.
Yeah,
right.
Therapy for each other, and that's mostly what it was.
And that's a fine balance, because you can't just make a film. I just don't like films where they're just two people talking, unless if it's like a Linklater film or something like that.
Right.
He just does it so amazingly well. But so if you can't just have scenes where just people are talking, what other elements are gonna accentuate the themes and accelerate the issues in these relationships and put them to the forefront.
Well, you have a real strength with building these characters that that have a true love between them, but in very difficult scenarios and very difficult histories. And both with Gook and this film, it's really wonderful how you pull that off.
So is that a question or just a statement?
That's me starting the critically acclaimed part again.
Yeah, there you go. But sorry, did you have?
Oh yeah, this film was really personal to me. I took care of an ailing father for about 10 years. Sorry, wow. And I wanted to know where you got the story from.
Well, just the way you're reacting to it. That's exactly why I made it. The first few interviews I did, I couldn't get through talking about it without like totally losing it.
Yeah.
Because this film is about me. I have a younger sister and we've had a lot of tough times and we love our parents and we've had some difficult times with our parents, specifically my mother, not my father actually, sometimes we just can't get along, and sometimes we can, but to me and my sister, like, our parents are everything. And it's just being immigrant kids and everything. I think Tiffany says this a lot, is this movie's for our parents, and everybody, that's why it's relatable. Everybody has to go through this at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I'll give you a hug. I'll give you a hug afterwards.
I'll go to the lighter question now. I want to talk about the music selection for this film and how it's just, it's kind of all over the place, but then it's not.
Yeah.
And the Proclaimers, really? You're just gonna throw that into the film, like in the middle with him pushing the father around LA. Yeah. Loved it.
I think, my music taste personally is pretty eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
I like everything. I even like country,
Yeah.
And Proclaimers, that particular song, I just adore that song because it just reminds me of my childhood.
Not the Kasingle.
Yeah.
Kasingle, yeah. There's a word.
I know,
look,
I'm dating
up.
Myself. Yeah.
But the needle drops, specifically the Mexican music, like Chavela Vargas' Paloma Negra. That film was a wreck from Octavio, who's not here right now. He plays Octavio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I asked him, is there a song that kind of encapsulates pain? And he's like, I got the perfect thing for you. And it seems like it's all over the place, but there's a theme that runs through all of those songs. And
I meant that in a good way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. No, I took it in that way. Oh, we only have a minute. I'm going to talk faster.
Yeah, no.
The score was really, really, really hard to nail. Because basically I was asking Roger, my composer, to write a Beatles track. Simple, memorable, and impactful, and repeatable.
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult to do. So I pushed him really hard. There was a point where he was like, I can't do any more changes to the score. This is the limit.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept pushing, and I think he would even say he's really, really happy with it.
Yeah.
I do have to throw in before we before we get out of here that the scene where we're pushing the dad around in the bed, I immediately thought of the Monkees TV series.
Yeah.
And I was like, going, that cannot be a reference that Justin was going for with that thing. But that's immediately what I thought of when I saw that. Really quickly, we don't have much time, mm-hmm. but I also want you to talk about the color design of the film because it's great.
Yeah. So Antti, my cinematographer, also worked on Gook. And, we talked about this for 2 years, trying to figure out what the look was going to be. Los Angeles is very hard to photograph. There's not one single identity. It's all over the place. It's flat. The colorscape is all over the place. So we decided on like a purple and green color palette. The green people don't really notice, but if you look, there's a green tint throughout the whole film. Mm. And, we had, as you can tell with our traditional dresses, is purple and... they just complement pretty well. And it was a lot of trial and error. We did camera tests and checked their skin tones and we're trying to figure out what the look was gonna be. But that I gotta give credit to Antti. Like, he really stepped up this time and I hope my dream is to be like a Chivo and Cuaron like duo, I hope to spend my career like working with him constantly.
Well, you're now on record saying that, so I'm sure he's
right. Oh, but I'm not saying like I, you know, I'm not saying that.
All right, again, the film is Miss Purple, playing at Sundance. We've had with us Justin Chan, the director, Chris Din, co-writer, and the two stars of the film, Tiffany Chu and Teddy Lee. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Not for the hug. I'm going to give you that
aww
hug.
We're wrapping up the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. The show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors include Black Rain, hemp-infused products that focus on wellness, relief, and recovery, Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Caroline Cromwell of Slope Style Realty of KW Park City, Keller Williams Real Estate. Additional support is provided by Nasty Women Wines, Pro Bar, Uinta Brewing, Couple Co. Podcast, and Whole Foods Market in Park City. This show is audio produced by Charlene Goto with production help from Angela Rowling and Sophie Gunther. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan.
Tune in on Monday, which will include interviews with the crew and Tracy Edwards, subject of the documentary film Maiden. And from the film Mope, we'll have director Lucas Hine, David Arquette, and the rest of the cast. Have a great weekend. We'll see you then.